The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Yeah, it is. It's Friday, January 11th, 2019. This is the Seth Leibson Show. I am Seth. Our phone number is 602-508-0960. Give us a call. Let's have some fun today. It deserves to be a fun Friday, and the weather is cooperating. All is good. I was kind of playing with a thought, something about the progressive movement, something about the Marxist notion of changing history. How did Marx put it? He wrote, "Philosophers have hitherto only interpreted the world in various ways. The point is to change it," close quote. One could, and Marx, in really in almost all respects, meant history by using the word world. It's actually rooted in the word progressive, isn't it? The idea of changing history. And they're doing it in a lot of different ways. The old is bad and must be replaced. You can certainly see this debate playing out in our border security debate. All of a sudden, we find ourselves as conservatives, though I don't believe this should be a conservative issue, having to prove and being on the defensive in having to prove that walls work. We're told they're medieval. We're told that they're unnecessary. We're told that they're immoral. So what if they're old? Their utility has borne out, as anyone living in a gated community knows. As any occupant of the White House, including Bill Clinton and Barack Obama, know. As any occupant of the Naval Observatory, where the vice president, like Joe Biden and Al Gore, would know. So do wheels, as the president has pointed out. Old does not mean bad. I might even say a moat is medieval. But guess what, Senator Schumer? Manhattan is surrounded by one. Of course, the left is about taking down monuments and statues, too. That's a history they want to change. Their point, again, not to interpret, but to change. It's our country. The word for this, I believe, is iconoclasm. Think about what they want to do to the Electoral College, for example. And think about where all of this started. It started in education. There's a reason 50% of high school seniors earn an F in American history. We don't teach it well. We teach, of course, what we love, and too many simply do not love our history because they've been taught for generations now, at least two, that our story is a story of misery and oppression, when in fact, in point of fact, it may very well be the second greatest story ever told. And of course, it's not just history in our schools. All kinds of education reforms have plagued our education system for at least four generations. Diane Ravitch wrote a book about this about 20 years ago called Left Back. She points to all that was working, you know, up until about 1950 or so, and then was put in the hands, I should say stolen by the hands, of the progressive movement. As she points out, whenever or wherever the academic curriculum was diluted or minimalized, large numbers of children were pushed through the school system without the benefit of a real or a very good education. Why else do you think the high watermark for SAT scores in America was 1964? With all the technology and all the change, we can't get as good as we were in 1964. Maybe traditional schooling and education, traditional curricula, was too old, too traditional, if you will. Ravitch would go on to point out that as the academic curriculum lost its importance as the central focus of a school or the school system, the schools lost their anchors and sense of mission, their internal moral commitment to the intellectual development and advancement of each child. This, of course, has now washed up, or perhaps I should say tsunamied up, to the post-secondary parts of education, to our colleges and universities. Try this on for size. According to the American Council of Trustees and Alumni, less than one-third of the U.S. News and World Report's top 25 liberal arts colleges, top 25 national universities, and top 25 public institutions require U.S. history as a requirement for history majors. They don't require U.S. history as a required course of study for history majors. Many institutions instead specify that history majors must take classes in areas outside the United States. History majors at Williams College have the option of taking soccer and history in Latin America, a course called Make the Beautiful Game. And students at Swarthmore can enroll in a course called, quote, Modern Addiction, Cigarette Smoking in the 20th Century, in order to fulfill their history major requirements, but not American history. According to the study, of the 23 programs that do list a requirement for U.S. history, 11 allow courses that are extremely narrow in scope. Let me read you the title of some of these courses. Here's one, Hip-Hop, Politics, and Youth Culture in America. That's one. Another one, Mad Men and Mad Women. These are the kinds of classes that fulfill the American history requirement at the University of Connecticut and Middlebury College, respectively, instead of courses that cover subjects such as, you know, the Revolutionary War or the Emancipation Proclamation. Michael Polakoff, ACTA's president, said historical illiteracy is the inevitable consequence of lax college requirements and that ignorance leads to civic disempowerment. While a lack of U.S. history in a history major's curriculum may produce graduates without a well-rounded history education, the study also shows that generally, college graduates also have a poor knowledge of American history and civic processes. Now you need not wonder anymore how the importance of free speech and the First Amendment can have any tug or pull anywhere with college students or their recent graduates who run our social media. Now you need not wonder how it is that there can be a serious appetite to get rid of the Electoral College. Now you need not wonder how it is that laws you thought mattered don't have to matter at all in the hands and brains of our courts and judges. You see, precedent, which is what usually runs our courts and judges, is nothing more than history. And remember, the purpose is to change it. Unless, of course, the precedent is but one single Supreme Court case. You know what I'm talking about, don't you? That one case has to be held sacrosanct. That's the only one. That case from 1973. But of course, it's a case that itself abnegates all known science and human physiology, that had to change it, if you will. That, for the progressives or neo-Marxists, was their goal. And of course, history is inconvenient in debates over the border, aren't they? Just erase and evade what the likes of Barack Obama and Chuck Schumer used to say and vote on and appropriate for the crisis they saw then. And declare, as if history starts afresh every morning, that the crisis is manufactured today and that border walls do not work and are of a sudden simply medieval. You see this move almost everywhere now, including in literature of the West and understanding of the West. Another study by the American Council found a mere 4 out of 52 top colleges and universities require English majors to take any course on Shakespeare or focused on Shakespeare. Institutions such as Harvard, Cal Berkeley, U.S. Naval Academy, Wellesley College. That's what we're talking about. What do these figures mean? For starters, of the Ivy League universities, only one requires its English majors to take a course in Shakespeare. Only 2 of the top 25, as ranked by U.S. News, have a Shakespeare requirement. The top 25 liberal arts colleges fare no better. Only 2 require English majors to study Shakespeare. It is a sad irony that not even Amherst College, which administers the Folger Shakespeare Library, requires its English majors to take a course that focuses on Shakespeare. Instead, the war against history and standards and the West has to be changed so that English majors today find a mind-boggling array of courses that center on politics, sociology, popular culture, sexuality, courses notable not because they focus on great literature, but on everything but that heritage. Heritage has to be changed too, don't you know? English classes today address a multiplicity of contemporary and often non-literary topics, such as, in their own words, courses like Creatures, Aliens, and Cyborgs. You can do that at Duke University instead of Shakespeare. Or at Emory, The Politics of Hip-Hop. Or at the University of Virginia, The Vietnam War in Literature and Film or Detective Fiction. or Cruising Home, Queer Kinship in Theory and Practice at Haverford, or HIV/AIDS and the Color Line, and Arab American Feminism and U.S. Film in the 1970s. That's Bates College. Or Literature, Food, and the American Diet. Believe it or not, that's at Princeton. You wonder why now, why we have to be defensive about things like explaining that walls are perfectly fine and work. Because, of course, the progressive effort here is to take history and change it. I'm Seth Liebson, 602-508-0960. Anything on your mind, love to hear from you. Happy Friday. Welcome back to the Seth Liebson Show, 602-5089-60. I'll get back to the shutdown in a moment and the border crisis in a second. I just wanted to lay a marker out here for a news item to watch. I'm a little skeptical of all the positives coming out of reports regarding Ruth Bader Ginsburg. I don't know anything you don't know, but she has obviously missed a week of arguments, and at age 85, we are blessedly told she is cancer-free now. That's great, having had two, nodes or nodules removed from her lung, cancerous ones. So glad to hear it, and may she have the best of recoveries, of course. But at age 85, she's not even in Washington, D.C. My point here has less to do with her individually than what this could mean for all of us, for the whole country, if indeed Donald Trump will have yet a third Supreme Court nominee to go up. Think about that. He's already put two on the bench. That's a pretty good number for a president to be able to put on a bench. He could have three. Stephen Breyer is 80. He could have four. Clarence Thomas is 70. Don't need to replace him, gosh knows. But if he wanted to infuse younger blood, he can always pull that cord too. So something to watch, something to think about. I heard on another show someone speculating on this vis-a-vis how hard the left fought the last nominee. One of the things that may make it more difficult if Donald Trump indeed does have another nominee for the Supreme Court, is what it would mean if he were to nominate a woman. And there is one. In fact, I was hoping she would have been the nominee last go-round, and that's Amy Coney Barrett from the Seventh Circuit out of Chicago. I think she would be just a fine and fantastic Supreme Court justice. And also highlight, I believe, this growing frustration the Democratic Party seems all of a sudden to have with members of the Catholic faith. We'll get into that a little bit later, too. But have you been tracking what some of the Democratic U.S. senators are saying about nominees who are members of organizations like the Knights of Columbus? As if, I suppose, that's a medieval organization, too. Let me, just having left that as a bookmark and something for us to keep our eyes on, and I think it's important to keep our eyes on, go back to the border crisis that we're at right now. I think today marks the third week of the shutdown, of the government, the partial government shutdown. And Mark Thiessen, who worked in the first term of the second Bush administration, I guess that's the way to put it, George W. Bush's administration, he wrote a really, I think, important and poignant piece, and I'd like to raise some of it with you. I did not know this, but this will, barring some kind of miraculous breakthrough, by tomorrow become the longest government shutdown in American history. I didn't know that. But it's also hit another milestone. It is by far and away the stupidest government shutdown in American history. The federal government this year will spend a whopping $4.4 trillion. $4.4 trillion. Yet Congress and the president are shutting down the government in a dispute between the $1.3 billion the Democrats have approved for border security and the $5.7 billion the president is demanding. Precisely 0.0998% of the total federal budget, what we used to call rounding errors. Worse, Democrats are doing it over a border wall strikingly similar to one that they almost unanimously supported not 5 years ago. While House Speaker Nancy Pelosi now says that a wall is an immorality, back in 2013 she supported a bill that required the construction of 700 miles of border fencing. The bill negotiated by the Gang of Eight, you may recall that phrase, included current Democratic Senators Charles Schumer and Dick Durbin, declared that, quote, not later than 180 days after the enactment of this act, the Secretary of Homeland Security shall establish the southern border fencing strategy to identify where 700 miles of fencing, including double layer, should be deployed along the southern border, close quote. It's not all. The bill further said, quote, that the secretary may not adjust the status of aliens who have been granted registered provisional immigration status until 6 months after a written certification that there is in place along the southern border no less than 700 miles of fencing. In other words, Democrats agreed that no illegal immigrants could get a path to citizenship at all until 700 miles of border had been completely secured. Every Senate Democrat voted for the Gang of Eight bill, including 36 Democratic senators still serving today. President Barack Obama agreed to sign it. Indeed, he praised the bill for including what he called, quote, the most aggressive border security plan in our history, close quote, and said that, quote, the Senate bill is consistent with the key principles for common sense reform that I have repeatedly laid out. This bears repeating. Obama said a 700-mile double fence on the southern border was consistent with the principles of the Democratic Party. Pelosi supported the Gang of Eight bill, saying, quote, every piece of this legislation has had bipartisan support. But now, today, we have a government shutdown over a wall much like the one that Pelosi and Senate Democrats fully supported just 5 years ago. As Obama said at the time, quote, the bipartisan bill that passed was a compromise, close quote. But today, Democrats are refusing to compromise or lay out what concessions they would accept in exchange for wall funding. When Trump rhetorically backed off the wall and talked about steel slats, Democrats ignored it. That's a fence, by the way. Democrats ignored it. When Vice President Mike Pence reportedly offered a deal for $2.5 billion, Democrats dismissed it. In a White House meeting Wednesday, Trump asked Pelosi whether, if he agreed to end the shutdown and negotiate separately on border security, she would support wall funding. She said no. This is ridiculous. In their response to the president's address to the nation, Schumer and Pelosi accused Trump of manufacturing a crisis. This is nothing short of fake, false, and untrue. As the Washington Post reported this week, the United States now faces, quote, a bona fide emergency on the border as record numbers of migrant families are streaming into the United States, overwhelming border agents and leaving holding cells dangerously overcrowded with children, many of whom are falling sick, close quote. Democrats could not possibly be in a better position to demand concessions from Trump if they had a manufactured crisis. So put some demands on the table. Let's hear from them. If Democrats think they have Trump cornered, then squeeze him and try and get something out of him. But don't refuse to negotiate and tell us that a wall is medieval or immoral, because their voting history shows not even they believe that. 602-508-0960. Be right back. Welcome back to the Seth Leibson Show, 602-508-0960. Adam is in Surprise. Hi, Adam.
Hi. Sorry, one second. I'll pull over here. How you doing?
I'm fine, sir. How are you?
Good. I just wanted to add some credence to you. I got my bachelor's degree in history, and I double majored with religious studies back in 2009.
Yes, sir.
And I was a little surprised to find out I couldn't take history of whatever I wanted. They forced me to take, a various assortment of classes that were all over the world. And then I was actually wanted to tell you, too, is the reason I double majored with religion was because they told me I had maxed out how many history classes I could take.
For your history major.
I went in as a history major, and they said you need 40 more units, but you could only take 3 more units of history.
Isn't that fascinating? You wanted to graduate with a degree in history, and they limited how many history courses you could take. I think that's fascinating.
Right. And then on the religious studies side of things, I couldn't just study Christianity if I wanted to. I had to take X amount of classes of Middle Eastern religions and Southeast Asian religions. And there was an Islam class that was required and a few others. Overall, it was really fascinating, but it was just...
Did they have a class on Christianity?
I believe they did. I actually started with a class on the Hebrew Bible,
okay.
The Old Testament.
Oh, sure. Okay.
So it's not that I wasn't allowed to take it at all.
Okay.
It's that I was hamstrung by having to take the rest.
I ask out of wonder about how they teach those courses. More as myth or taking the founders of Christianity as seriously as they took themselves. That was what my curiosity was. I've never taken kind of course.
I was told once not to take things too literally on the Hebrew Bible class.
Yeah.
But if we're studying it as the Hebrews read it, why wouldn't it be taken? But whatever. They redefine the word myth. It doesn't mean a fake story. It just means a legendary story that's been told.
Mm-hmm.
Things like that. And then it did.
I bet they don't use the word legend. I bet they don't use the word legend in the course on Islam.
I don't recall.
I bet they don't. I just bet they don't.
But every teacher seemed to be of the religion that they were teaching for the most part.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, or
sure.
At least by mouth service, but.
Sure. Okay.
But I just wanted to add some credence to what you were saying.
Yeah. Thanks. It's a sad thing. Not enough people pay attention to this sort of thing, but we're not just uneducating and miseducating. We're non-educating.
Right.
Yeah,
and they said the reason we don't need American history is because that's what we were taught in high school.
Right.
Not really.
Right. Not really. And this is the tragedy of all education is every level of educator assumes that the work had been done the year before. I'm trying to remember what the last stats I saw, but it's something like in math and English, 60% of college freshmen across the country require remedial education.
That sounds about accurate.
Yeah, and there's something like 60% of four-year college students do not graduate within 8 years. That's even more astounding to me. That's astounding to me. You graduated what year, Adam?
Back in 2009.
And how many years did it take you? Were you a full-time student?
I was. I did community college or whatever the proper term is now.
Yeah.
And I did that for 2.5 semesters just because of timing, and then I did university in the full 2 years.
Okay, so basically 4 years, which is what we all kind of grew up thinking college was. My question to you is this. Do you remember how many peers you had in college who had been there 5 or more years or who were taking 5 or more years to complete their degree? Do you remember that there were a few or a lot?
I let's put it this way. There was a term that was not new to anybody that it was called a fifth-year senior.
A fifth-year senior, right? And good luck if they did it in 5 years, right?
Right?
We joked when. So I'm a bit older. Having graduated, when did I graduate college? 1991 is when I graduated. I had to stop and think for a moment. I graduated in 91, and I went to a relatively small college. And I can safely say I could count on one hand how many people were on the 5 or more year plan. I'm going to a break, and I want to get you and Mike in. I want to get Mike, too. Can you hold just a second? I got to go to a break, and we'll come right back.
Yes, sir.
Thank you. Adam, we'll be right back. Mike, don't go away. Others can join, too. 602-508-0960. Michael Rubin coming up at the next hour on everything Mike Pompeo said in Egypt yesterday. I'm Seth. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Seth Liebson Show. We were talking with Adam in Surprise, who was validating my claims about what goes on at the college campus vis-a-vis the study of history and the study of literature and the time it takes people to get through these things, amassing ever greater debt as they learn less and less. Adam, I was headed to the break, so I didn't want to go without you having a final word if you wanted one, so I appreciate your patience.
No, I said pretty much what I was going to say. Just, disappointed that I couldn't just study history. I mean, it was eye-opening at the time, and then looking back on it, just kind of, sticks out even more.
There's good and bad news to this for those who like American history. The good news is that we as adults tend to get it. We tend to acquire it because we have been blessed with people who mostly aren't professors like David McCullough and write and scribble out great American history, and we can't seem to get enough of it. So his books, you know, are number one bestsellers when he does them. But that's for those of us that actually like this country and want to study it. It's too bad he couldn't have it in a college history course. And I'm going to guess he would have a hard time getting tenure today, given the focus of his work. It's the reason I left academia, you know. No one wanted a white Aristotle person. Thank you, Adam. I appreciate it.
Yes,
Have a
sir.
Really good weekend. Mike is in Cave Creek. Hi, Mike.
Hello. Good afternoon to you, Seth. This is Michael from Cave Creek. And I have a quick comment on the Ginsburg situation.
Yeah.
I'm sure you realize that the this was reserved. Ginsburg was nominated because she is Jewish, and therefore Dems will again press that issue to nominate a Jewish jurist into the Supreme Court. So I think while Bennett is wonderful and Catholic, which is what I am, it seemed to me that this is going to be a huge, huge problem. And that's going to be another grudge that Dems will use to block the nomination. If Mr. Trump decides.
Mike, I'm not sure if I agree with you on the premise, frankly. I don't know that what you say is true is true. I don't know that she was nominated because she was Jewish. I think there's a better case to say she was nominated because she was liberal and female. She replaced Byron White, who was not Jewish. And I remember being pretty attentive at the time of her nomination because I was on my way to law school at the time and we just pay extra. I just don't remember the Jewish part coming up. Quite frankly, I just don't.
It's called, so check that again, please. And I think you'll find that is the case.
How would I find that out? What would be the way to do that?
Well, you know, the way that I researched that is through American jurisprudence, and there were several articles that specifically state.
Really?
Right. Yes, and that's how I found out about it.
Hmm.
And before that, if you remember, there was another Jewish jurist that was nominated for a position. And her nomination was blocked because of the fact she employed employed a nanny, and she didn't give her any tax documents.
Okay, I know of what you're speaking, right? Because Ruth Bader Ginsburg wasn't the first choice. I remember that, and this is when Britt Hume got into that shouting match with Bill Clinton, or actually got shouted at by Bill Clinton. Can we find that audio? That would be kind of fun. Bill Clinton, Britt Hume, Ruth Bader Ginsburg audio. Right, I remember that, Mike. I can't imagine there being any clamor. Really, I've never heard of such a thing. in the land requiring any clamor from anywhere in the population saying that the seat must be filled by a Jewish person. There are indeed at least one other, two other, I guess, Elena Kagan and Stephen Breyer, Jewish people on the Supreme Court. You know, I'm not opposed to it one way or the other. I'm going to guess right now that's not going to be the issue. I can't imagine what organization would demand it be so. I would more likely think that people would say female. That would be my guess. I know that there was traditionally a seat that was known as kind of the Jewish scholar's seat, which was the Brandeis Frankfurter Fortas lineage. That ended a long time ago. As far as I remember it, probably around 1969 or 70. So I'm having a hard time thinking that that's going to be an issue. I really don't. Now, what will be an issue, I think, Mike, you're right about, is the Catholicism of someone like Amy Coney Barrett. Something like that will be an issue because the Democrats, and I want to get into this in a little bit, the Democrats, it seems, in the Senate have a real problem with the Catholicism of a lot of judicial nominees, frankly. Dianne Feinstein has been hard on it. So too has Kamala Harris. So too have other senators who are talking about, you know, their membership in such things. With respect to male nominees, the Knights of Columbus and how deeply they hold their Catholic faith. There should be no inquiry into this. There should be no religious test whatsoever into this. And I think the Democrats, if they want to wage this war, they're going to find themselves increasingly shrinking their popularity with the American public. It's still the largest church in America. It's still the largest church in America. There was another story, but thank you for your call, Mike. There was another story I wanted to bring to your attention here that I thought was just kind of interesting and fun and kind of something that also goes back to the to getting rid of tradition. And I had it here a second ago. It was from, yes, Wall Street Journal. Do you remember last spring when Starbucks chairman Howard Schultz announced that the coffee chain that Starbucks was going to allow everyone to use its restrooms, that their restrooms would be open to the public regardless of whether the person using the restroom was going to be a customer or not? Well, it's left the company with, as the Wall Street Journal reports, quite a mess. Quite a mess. Who would have seen that coming, huh? Starbucks is installing boxes for safe disposal syringes in the bathrooms of certain locations following workers' reports of discarded needles and sometimes concerning conditions. Quote, these societal issues affect us all and can sometimes place our partners, employees, in scary situations, which is why we have protocols and resources in place to ensure our partners are out of harm's way, said Reggie Borges of Starbucks. As of Wednesday, more than 3,700 people have signed a petition on coworker.org calling for Starbucks to place needle disposal boxes in high-risk bathrooms. This is a concession to a terrible part of our culture. Instead of saying only paying customers can use your bathroom, or instead of saying you cannot bring a needle into your bathroom, we are providing needle disposal boxes at Starbucks. This is insanity on stilts. I'm Seth Leibson. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Seth Leibson Show. I am Seth Leibson. Michael Rubin's going to join us at the top of the next hour. He of the American Enterprise Institute. He, I think, in my own mind at least, and certainly by the testimony of others, maybe one of the greatest living scholars of the Middle East right now. Mike Pompeo, Secretary of State, gave a big address in Egypt yesterday. And, you know, one of the interesting things about this time we live in is non-important stories come and go very quickly, and important stories come and go very quickly. The left likes to move us from crisis to crisis. One of the things I worry about in their deluge of that, the only thing they don't think is a crisis being the border, oddly enough, everything else is, one of the things I worry about in that deluge of crisis coverage, you know, Paul Manafort shared polling data with a Russian oligarch. Big deal. Big deal. I can share my polling. I can't share my polling data with someone. The problem would be, if anything, in the other direction, actually. You know, if he's getting information from them, not vice versa. Do you remember how Tony Blair was working with Bill Clinton on sharing electoral strategies, election strategies? It was a 2-day story. It required a huge major correction by the New York Times, but it crowded out other stories of import. Certainly it crowded out stories of things going on at the border, and certainly it crowded out the speech that Mike Pompeo was giving in Egypt, which was a hugely important speech, and I don't want to let go of it. I'm going to have Michael Rubin join us at the top of the next hour to analyze it. Also give us an update on the planned withdrawal from Syria and other hot spots going on in the Middle East that Mike Pompeo talked about. That having been said, I also want to return to the border and the shutdown and the efforts that CNN is engaging in that are helping us make our argument. It's not just what Jim Acosta reported and put out yesterday. It's not just that. Oh, no. It's far, far more than that. They are digging a real hole for themselves, and they're not going to be able to crawl out of it. Maybe we should instruct them and remind them that holes are medieval and old technology. But then again, because it's hurting CNN, maybe we shouldn't, and we should let them keep digging. We'll talk about all of that on the other side. I'm Seth Leibson. You're listening to The Seth Leibson Show. We'll be right back.
Three-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.